Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The first confirmed case of COVID-19 in the United States was reported on January 19th, 2020. On March 11th, 2020, 5 years ago today, the World Health Organization declared COVID to be a global pandemic. Thinking back, most of us had no idea what we were in for. And as the infection spread and the healthcare industry was overwhelmed, as businesses and schools closed, as we stayed home, donned masks when we ventured outside, even wiped down our groceries and dealt with toilet paper shortages, we just struggled to make sense of it all. It is not an exaggeration to say that COVID changed everything, and even though the pandemic is over, we are still recovering. We are fortunate that scientists were able to quickly develop a vaccine that brought the virus under control, and it is also true that the first Trump administration played a valuable role in fast-tracking the development of that vaccine through what they called Operation Warp Speed. It was the bright spot in the pandemic, which allowed the vaccines to become available much earlier than would have been possible with typical timelines. And yet, Trump also created an environment that politicized the vaccines and the public health officials who were advising both him and rank-and-file Americans. Today, we look back on what we lived through and what we've learned from all of this. 5 years ago, Dr. Katie Passeretti was one of the people we turned to quite frequently for information and advice. She is Vice President and Enterprise Chief Epidemiologist at Atrium Health. And for those who don't remember, Dr. Passeretti was the first person in North Carolina to get the COVID vaccine when it became available, and she lived to tell the tale. Dr. Passeretti, welcome to the program. She joins us along with Dr. Raynard Washington, Mecklenburg County Public Health Director, and Joe Bruno is here. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. He's here to remind us of the news developments that we all experience. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Before we get too deeply into this, let me get your top of the mind, most vivid memory of that day 5 years ago when the World Health Organization declared COVID a pandemic. What were your first thoughts? Ladies first, Dr. Passeretti, your first thoughts that day?
You know, I think inevitability, we had the sense that it was coming and that, you know, we had much to learn over time. I think not knowing what would come, there were a lot of things running through my mind, from worst case scenarios, which, you know, ended up being closer to worst case scenarios than best case scenarios. But, you know, feeling a little bit overwhelmed, a little bit scared, a lot of people reaching out with questions and fear, frankly. So trying to stay calm, think through next steps, and make sure everyone stayed as safe as possible.
Dr. Washington.
Well, I think I'd agree. I mean, it really was a matter of thinking to yourself, like, wow, this is really happening. And like, wow, I have to really work now in a different kind of way. For me personally, it was also pretty scary because I was actually at the time still living in Philadelphia and packing to move to Charlotte just a few days later. It was a lot of anxiety for me getting to a new place, a new city, and having to sort of mobilize really quickly to help the response.
And your predecessor, Gibby Harris, I'm sure was delighted to see you come in at the start of this pandemic, so she didn't have to deal with it. And Joe, what about you? Because you come at this from a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it was the day after Super Tuesday, wasn't it? If you think back, or about a week afterwards, if I remember correctly. And we were still in election mode. You know, that was when Joe Biden had just won all the states on Super Tuesday. And we were covering that. And then we have the Checkers canceling games. We have the Whitewater Center canceling their Green River Revival. That's when the events started to trickle in. And I kind of just remember working nonstop because it was like a snow day on steroids with the amount of event cancellations and the amount of uncertainty. And that we kind of had to guide the audience to what would end up being their lives for the next 2.5 years.
And I guess you and I and everybody else in this business, the broadcasting business, we're in the business of trying to figure out how to do this without scaring people to death, and also to understand that ourselves. I remember doing a series of programs just talking about viruses and how they operated and what constitutes a pandemic or an epidemic and how you get that under control. I mentioned that the World Health Organization declared COVID to be a global pandemic on this day 5 years ago. 2 days later, the Trump administration declared a nationwide emergency and issued a travel ban for non-U.S. citizens coming in from 26 European countries, because if you recall, the outbreak was particularly severe in some of those countries, like Italy. The next day, March 14th, 2020, the CDC issued a no-sail order for all cruise ships. On March 16th, this is happening very, very quickly, the shutdowns of schools and restaurants and bars began in some states. Joe, do you recall when we began to close things here in Charlotte or in North Carolina?
It was that week. That was really the first major week that events started to cancel. I remember there was somewhat of a controversy, like, would the big St. Patrick's Day bar crawl be canceled or would it be postponed? And, you know, if it does happen, where is everybody going to go and how is that going to work with COVID? And people were joking like, if you attend there, you're immune from all diseases. But that was like the first weekend that major events started to cancel, or in at that time they were saying, we'll just postpone for 2 months. This is going to be a short thing. You know, we'll stay home. We'll do the bar crawl. We'll do the event in June. And little did we know, June wasn't a safe option either.
Right. When was the first case, Dr. Washington? I know you were just coming into this at the time, but when was the first case of COVID detected in Mecklenburg County or in North Carolina for that matter? And how quickly did it multiply in terms of the numbers of cases?
Yeah, the first case here in Mecklenburg was reported around March the 8th. And that actually happened a few days after the 8th, but that was when the person was actually tested. And from there, we had a couple of cases. And I remember we could actually, you know, keep like tick marks of how many cases we had. And then eventually that grew and we no longer were able to keep count. We used to also have a folder for every single case that we were creating, and very quickly as the cases began to escalate in the community, we were not able to keep up with the volume that we had as that happened so fast.
In terms of media coverage, Dr. Passeretti, and how this impacted healthcare, New York City seemed to be the epicenter for the longest time, with horrific pictures and stories coming out of New York about the overload on the hospital workers, about overloads on hospitals, patients not being able to get care, patients on ventilators, patients being triaged outside the hospitals, patients, morgues, temporary morgues being set up outside these hospitals. We never had it that bad, I don't believe, but how bad did it get in this area?
Yeah, it never got as bad as those first days in New York, but we did have to open accessory units like outside the hospital, inside the hospital to care for the volume of patients. We had patients everywhere and certainly had our ICUs and people needing kind of high levels of care were way higher than we'd ever seen before. So while it wasn't as bad as New York City in those first days, it certainly was quite bad here. I think, you know, hard to compare to those first days. And we're lucky to learn geographically, New York got hit first. So there were some lessons learned that we were able to put into place, but it was scary times being on the front line, seeing patients in healthcare.
It kind of changed everything, Joe, particularly the way people in the media covered stories. I remember reporters being masked up on TV, et cetera, because you couldn't get near people. And we were often just a step ahead of the public in terms of what we knew. And so we wanted to couch what we were hearing from public health officials and what we were anecdotally reporting on in a way that didn't overly alarm people, but did let them know this is really serious. How difficult was that for rank and file reporters to deal with?
It kind of upended how we did our jobs. March 11th, 2020 also was the day that the Charlotte Observer had a potential exposure to coronavirus. And I think it was just a reporter at the Observer happened to be at a conference with thousands of attendees. And one of the conference attendees tested positive. But in all that uncertainty, they shut down like the newsroom for 2 weeks. They made everyone work from home because that person was possibly exposed to somebody who had COVID at an event where, you know, hundreds or thousands of people attended. So, you know, think about that. Like one person gets COVID at this event with, you know, 1,000 people there, and you had a person who attended that event, and then you're bringing that back. I mean, it just shows you how seriously we took contact tracing back then, where, you know, there was potentially an exposure to someone who was potentially exposed. In terms of how we did our jobs, we all worked from home. Obviously, if you're watching TV, you saw we were all wearing masks. We were in the field. Reporters were doing silly things like taping microphones to hockey sticks so you could be 6 feet apart from the people that you were interviewing. Of course, Zoom became more popular. That's one of the best things of the pandemic is Zoom and the ability to just fire up an interview in 5 minutes and record it on your screen and get it out to the world instantly. But it really did change how we work.
You know, Dr. Washington, COVID is still with us. It hasn't disappeared. It's going to probably be with us forever. And perhaps we've got it under control because of herd immunity brought on in large part by these vaccines that were produced quickly, which we'll talk about. But Joe just mentioned that that Observer reporter went to a conference of 1,000 people. One person had it, and there was this alarm that they were going to get it, etc. How was it more contagious at first than it is today, or is it simply under control now because of the number of people who have been vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, there's been a wide variety of sort of estimates of how transmissible various strains of COVID have been. It's important to remember that it's not all the same strain that's been circulating. And so I would say that there certainly were subsequent strains that were believed to be more transmissible than the earlier initial strains. But certainly that it's still a highly contagious virus in and of itself. And so especially in the early days when we knew very little about it and how fatal it was, we had early estimates of what we thought the mortality would look like associated with COVID, some of which were really, really scary to us as epidemiologists. And so certainly thinking about that time, you know, even one or two people being exposing a large group of people would have been a scary thing.
So, Dr. Passeretti, I was looking yesterday through the North Carolina Health and Human Services COVID case timeline, and if I read it correctly, this state experienced its first concerning uptick in the number of cases in July of 2020, followed by a larger uptick in January 2021, and then an enormous uptick in January 2022, along with concurrent spikes in the number of COVID deaths. And after that, the cases fall off precipitously. But the first vaccines to receive emergency use authorization were in December of 2020. So how do you explain the spikes in infections and deaths into the next year?
Yeah, you know, part is related to changes in strains and the transmissibility. You know, part is related to who got vaccinated, how the uptake of vaccines were. So, you know, even we've had flu vaccines for forever. This year is a prime example. We still see significant disease even with the vaccine. The goal of the vaccine is to kind of decrease that severity of illness, attempt to reduce some transmission. And we have to respect that viruses change over time, and our prevention strategies have to reflect that.
I want to talk about these vaccines because they came into being very remarkably quickly, lightning speed. And I want to talk about why that was able to happen and if that has caused some people to be more hesitant than they might have been because of the speed at which these were delivered and why that should not be a concern. We've talked about this in the past, but we'll talk about it again to just refresh everybody's memory with Dr. Katie Passeretti from Atrium Health, Dr. Raynard Washington from Mecklenburg County Health Department, and Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. Dr. Katie Passaretti is with us, Vice President and Chief or Enterprise Chief Epidemiologist at Atrium Health. Dr. Raynard Washington is Public Health Director for Mecklenburg County. And Joe Bruno joins us from WSOC-TV Channel 9. We're talking about COVID. 5 years ago today, it was declared by the World Health Organization to be a global pandemic. On March 17th, Moderna. This is March 11th was the day 5 years ago. March 17th, 6 days later, Moderna began the first human trials of a vaccine to protect against COVID. Dr. Washington, talked to me about how that was possible within 6 days to start a vaccine trial for a new virus.
Well, I think first, there were some administrative loopholes that were lifted because of the pandemic emergency. And so they were able to move through some of the initial sort of planning phases of that trial without having to go through as much review that you typically would have because of the emergency. But I think the other reality is that those scientists were already working on that technology and that approach to vaccination for years prior to, and were able to mobilize really, really quickly based on the genetic sequencing of the COVID strain that was spreading, and be able to sort of test a candidate vaccine for use. And so that allowed us, those investments in science over the decades, not just in that year, allowed us to be more prepared than we would have been if we had not been investing prior to.
You called it a new technology, and we're talking about this. It was an entirely new kind of vaccine, an mRNA vaccine. But it's only new to us, the public. It wasn't necessarily new to medical researchers, correct?
That is correct. Yeah. So we just most of our common vaccines do not use that approach to are not developed in that way. But it had been around for several decades prior to.
And Dr. Passaretti, as I said in the beginning, you were the first person in North Carolina to get the shot. When you got it, how did that happen? How did you become the first person? Secondly, when you got it, did you have any misgivings? Were you unsure of what you were doing? Did you think, I have to do this because I'm kind of the point person here, but oh gosh, here we go.
Yeah, you know, that day we knew we were getting vaccine supply in. And that morning I got a call and said, can you get to XYZ location by 10 a.m.? You know, we want you to have the first dose of vaccine. At that time, it was within our system because I was seen as a leader of the COVID response and had built relationships and trust amongst the healthcare workers. So, you know, honestly, I look back at that as an honor that I was asked. You know, as far as feeling scared, I really wasn't. You know, I understand the science behind the vaccines. I felt like it was a turning point and would make a huge difference for our patients after we had seen such devastation over the prior months. So, you know, I really didn't have hesitation when they asked. I was like, yep, getting in my car.
I want to talk about the science behind it, but I remember getting the shot in a parking lot at Atrium, I believe, lining up behind other cars, and you'd roll down your window, they'd give you the shot, they'd tell you to pull over for 15 or 20 minutes because they didn't want you to get sick or dizzy. Was that an overabundance of caution? I never got dizzy, I never got sick. Did anybody? Was that because we didn't know how people would react, or was it because we thought people might be scared and might react that way psychosomatically, and therefore they should sit tight for 20 minutes?
Yeah, I would say a combination of all the things. You know, it was a new vaccine. We wanted to err on the side of caution and make sure that people, you know, there was for some people, a lot of anxiety around getting the vaccine. Some people have baseline anxiety around needles, period. And really with any vaccine, there's a post-vaccination monitoring timeframe that folks are, in theory, supposed to adhere to. So I think we were erring on the cautious side to make sure people tolerated it. And we also didn't want the message that these vaccines are dangerous, right? Like we just wanted to make sure that they were being watched. We could confidently say people are tolerating these vaccines and have benefit.
The science behind this, traditional vaccines, the flu vaccine that we get, most of us get every year, uses an inactivated virus, and those inactivated viruses provoke the body's immune response, and in most cases do not lead to full-blown infection. Sometimes you might come down with the flu from the flu shot, but not very often. The COVID vaccines are these mRNA, messenger RNA vaccines, and they trigger an immune response, as I understand it, without introducing the virus itself, which would seem on the surface to make not only make them more safe, but to make people feel more comfortable about getting them because there's no virus in the shot. Are they safer? And if so, and given the tremendous success of the COVID vaccines, why do some people still not trust them, Dr. Passeretti?
So they are tremendously safe. You know, we've been monitoring outcomes from the COVID vaccine for years now, and the serious side effects are very, very rare and very few and far between. And certainly continue to see that the vaccines help prevent severe illness. People that are vaccinated do better, don't end up in the hospital. And we still see, unfortunately, some deaths from COVID. So, you know, the vaccines are very safe and do what we want them to do, which is keep people out of the hospital, you know, with as minimal symptoms as possible.
I don't know, Joe, if you can answer this question or not, but I know that when these first vaccines became available, some people were clamoring to get them. And there were these long lines at places where they were giving them out. And as I said, I got my first shot lining up behind a row of cars with an appointment at an atrium facility up near the university. Still, other people wanted nothing to do with them. How big a problem was that here, people not wanting the shot? And what gave rise to the unfounded suspicion that these vaccines were not safe? Do you know the answer to that question?
I think one of the doctors may be better at talking about the vaccine skepticism, but I will say that the first two doses of vaccine were pretty popular. We got a lot of interest, and a lot of people did roll up their sleeves for the shot. If you remember back in that time frame, for months, all I was doing was just posting when a vaccine became available at a random Walmart or CVS in our area. I had a professional hockey player message me saying, I have to go back to, I forget which country it was, so I'm just going to say Russia, and I need a shot. I don't care where. Find me a J&J dose, because it was only one at the time, so I can get this vaccine and go play hockey. And I found him a clinic in Oakboro, North Carolina, where he was able to get a Johnson & Johnson dose. But they were extremely hard to get at first. There was extreme interest, and I think people saw the vaccine too as a way out of the pandemic. And then somewhere down the line, the skepticism really increased to the point where we are today.
I had forgotten that you had this. You were the go-to guy on Twitter at the time in terms of posting where the shots were available. I mean, we talked about that on the news roundup with you back then all the time. Dr. Washington, do you have a theory as to why these vaccines got a bad reputation or by some people?
Yeah, I think a few things happened. I think first and foremost, there, we realized quickly the role that social media was having and how information was spreading really, really quickly. And sometimes in the case of, for example, Joe's tweets, that was very effective and helpful because it allowed us to make sure that we were maximizing use of the vaccine. And in other cases, we saw that wasn't helpful because folks were spreading information that wasn't verified or factual. And sometimes that looked like individuals, you know, reporting false side effects of the vaccine, or people reporting that they, one of the really challenging things was folks who said they got COVID after they got the vaccine, right? Getting people to understand that the vaccine wouldn't prevent you ultimately from getting COVID infections was a really challenging thing. And people started to doubt the effectiveness of the vaccine because folks were getting infections after they were vaccinated. not recognizing that the vaccine was protecting folks still from, as Dr. Prasaretti said earlier, from having severe illness and from dying. And so it's really important getting that message, getting ahead of that message became a huge challenge for us to make sure that we were communicating to the public.
The messaging was difficult. I mean, people don't understand science. Science is hard, and our only connection with science usually as a layperson is the doctor's office. That's the closest, and maybe the weather forecast on television is the closest that we get to actual science. But prior to the release of the vaccine, and as the virus was spreading and more people were dying, health officials at all levels were releasing what they knew. We were all learning about this virus in real time. And so health officials were coming on television and telling people what they knew and precautions they thought would be helpful. Sometimes they were right. Sometimes they discovered themselves, well, we don't need to do that. That's not part of the deal. Wiping down your groceries is not necessary. But this caused confusion in the public, and it resulted in the impression by some that health professionals did not have the answers. So did public health officials learn anything, Dr. Washington, from that experience that might change how they handle future pandemics of new and unknown viruses and diseases?
Yeah, I think certainly we learned a ton, especially about communication and the importance of frequent, transparent, regular communication. But also, I think it's really challenging to think about what happens when this happens again, right? Because you know, we will still be in a situation where we may not know what the virus is, how it behaves, how it transmits, and unfortunately, we have to learn those things in real time. And so, it is difficult to think about a world where the next pandemic comes. Because we will have to probably learn on the job as well at that same time as we see how the virus or whatever the organism is behaves in public.
By the end of April of that first year, 5 weeks after the World Health Organization declared the global pandemic, the U.S. quickly overtook, Dr. Prasaretti, the rest of the world in the number of infections and the number of deaths. We surpassed Italy and Spain as the global hotspot for this virus. Was that just due to the natural progression of the disease around the world? Did it have to do with the population density of the epicenter in this country, at least of New York City? What was it, because of something we were doing or not doing, that we took the mantle of being having the most cases?
Yeah, I do think in part it's population density where the infection was introduced, you know, New York spreading out so quickly from that kind of center city where people kind of come in, come out all the time. So it was part that, you know, I think different countries had different approaches to prevention that, you know, we learned from along the way. So I think it's a combination of factors for why, you know, our country did that.
Yeah, and I think it's also, Mike, to note that there's, you know, we didn't have a single federal policy around how we were responding, right? So, you know, states made decisions different from one another. And while geographic boundaries seem like they're real borders, they're not really real borders. And so the variation that we saw, particularly in the South, where there were different sets of rules for different places, did also contribute to how well we were able to contain.
Do we have a set of national standards now or national procedures now, and or should we?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly coordination at the federal level is really critical when you're responding to any infectious disease outbreak that's crossing multiple states. You see what's happening right now with measles and other infections. It's really important to have that federal coordination. It's also important to have local and state partners at the table to see what to report and coordinate what's happening on the ground. And so that all is really important. I think we still have a ways to go in being prepared for all hazards as a country. I don't think we're there yet. I do think that there's still opportunities to do that, to make sure that those systems are better coordinated and able to function together.
Well, COVID and our response to COVID and the public's response to our response to COVID has kind of poisoned the well here in a way, Dr. Prasaretti. I don't know that Dr. Washington answered the question, do we have a national response for future pandemics as a result of this? Do we?
I would say, you know, as Dr. Washington said previously, the next pandemic will be different from the one prior. So to some extent, there's no way to have a fully planned out, what do we do this next time? I think, as Dr. Washington referenced, there's opportunities for coordination at both the federal and the state level. And, you know, looking now that I'm in a role where I work with five different states, I see that there can be variability and where we still have opportunities for improvement.
Because these are infectious disease and they spread person to person, our first response, Joe, was to shut things down. And we did quickly shut down schools and public gatherings and bars and restaurants and movie theaters and live theaters. Proms and graduations went virtual or postponed or were canceled altogether. And the impact on frontline workers, service workers, was crippling. I remember having many conversations on this program with waiters and waitresses and bartenders and hairstylists about the impact it was having on their ability to make a living, to pay the rent, to buy their own groceries and take care of themselves, because many of them work paycheck to paycheck. By May of 2020, the unemployment rate in the United States, for those who don't remember, was 14.7%. That was the highest since the Great Depression. 20.5 million people were out of work. How long, Joe, did it take for governments at all levels to recognize the hardship that this was causing and bring those people some economic relief?
I will say there were some policies put in place by the government back then that were extremely helpful. And I think that people wish we still had the expanded unemployment payments. They kicked up the amount of money that people who were without a job were able to receive. The expanded child care tax credit did an amazing work at lifting people out of poverty. Those are policies that I think lawmakers wish there could be consensus on now to bring back, to really bring people some relief. But it was an extremely challenging time. Even if you were able to receive unemployment or get that expanded child tax credit, restaurants shut down and never reopened, stores closed, schools were out for more than a year, and the education gap is something I think we're still trying to make up for as a result. It was extremely, of course, unprecedented times where they took the action they thought was best during all of this, and in many ways, we're still recovering.
Yeah, and there's, of course, a lingering economic impact to this because of the money that was pumped into the economy to help people sustain themselves while they were out of work. And that takes a long time to reach stasis again. And I think that impacted the last election. And you mentioned school performance. That's a lingering impact of this because the students haven't recovered. Well, and we'll talk about that when we come back from the break. But has blaming the pandemic for everything become a crutch? Are the lingering impacts outside of school performance, are they real? Or are we on the cusp of moving beyond being able to blame the pandemic for everything? Joe, I have about 15 seconds.
Outside of school, I think it was used as a crutch up until a couple of years ago where people would just say, due to the pandemic, when maybe it wasn't necessarily because of the pandemic.
We'll talk about schools and the lingering impact of closing those schools and what we should do in the future should we face something else like this again when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about COVID 5 years after the day it was declared on this day in 2020 to be a global pandemic. Dr. Katie Passeretti is with us. She's Vice President and Enterprise Chief Epidemiologist at Atrium Health. Dr. Raynard Washington is Public Health Director at Mecklenburg County. And WSOC-TV's Joe Bruno is with us. He was the lifeline for a lot of people during that pandemic in terms of tweeting out and posting things like where to get the shots when they became available, among many other things. According, Joe, to the Education Recovery Scorecard released this week, the average U.S. student remains nearly half a grade level behind pre-pandemic achievement in both math and reading. And according to Professor Tom Kane, who is faculty director of the Center for Education Policy and Research at Harvard, unless state and local leaders step up now, he says, the achievement losses will be the longest lasting and most inequitable legacy of the pandemic. What has North Carolina, what has CMS, what have systems surrounding Charlotte been doing to address this?
you know, I think CMS certainly recognizes that there are profound impacts from the pandemic, and they recognize that this is not going to be immediate fix, that there's going to have to be more in more enhanced effort behind tutoring and care from some of the teachers to catch people up. I mean, if you think about it, I know I would have struggled if I was a student during the pandemic, because I just do not work well learning from a computer. And you think about all the younger kids who had to, you know, learn how to read and write virtually through a screen. There were some kids who, unfortunately, teachers really couldn't account for them because, you know, their home situations. They may not have had reliable internet service. They may not have logged on to Zoom as frequently as they would have attended in-person classes. These are problems that we didn't really have immediate answers for, and we're still trying to figure out how to catch students up.
And because of problems like that, and because of the devastating consequences of closing things had on the economy, Dr. Washington, there was a political push to reopen the economy, which was doing battle with the medical community, pushing to keep it closed in some cases to tamp down the spread of infection. Some states opened businesses and schools sooner than others. And I'm not going to ask which approach was right or wrong, but did we learn anything about the need for such draconian shutdowns and their efficacy that would change how we respond to something similar in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a decision that I think anyone made very lightly. I think it was a very thoughtful, delicate situation. We didn't have a lot of information about the virus, how it spread, the potential impact of it. And so I think that decision, no different in any other situation, would still be taken very seriously and assessed based on what we know at the time. Of course, there are consequences to having to take those kind of community level mitigation measures, but there are also consequences to not taking them, where people will get really, really sick. Our healthcare systems won't be able to serve those who are most sick, and people will unfortunately die. And so I think, as a reminder, the thousands of people here who lost their life could have been worse had we taken no efforts. And so I do think it's important, again, that we do that with great caution. It's not something you do for everything, but when you don't know, certainly that uncertainty will lend you to wanting to be more cautious.
I think it bears reminding people that I think well over a million people in this country died because of COVID. And then some of those who did not die are still suffering the effects of long-term COVID, and we're not even sure that they have experienced all of those effects. They may emerge later, and some people who are completely healthy today may experience long COVID effects later on in life. Dr. Anthony Fauci, then the head of the CDC, was the poster boy for how our federal government operated and the restrictions it issued. And for that reason, and because of the politicization of COVID and our approach to getting it under control, he also became the boogeyman for some on the right wing. How would you, Dr. Passeretti, assess his performance, the decisions he made, the recommendations he prescribed to keep the lid on COVID?
You know, it was, as has been referenced multiple times during this hour, an incredibly challenging time. And I think public health, Dr. Fauci, physicians generally were doing the best that they could and making the best decisions with the intent of saving people's lives. So did we learn as we went? Are there lessons learned on how we could tweak, you know, do things differently moving forward? 100%. But I think with what Dr. Fauci knew at that time, he was making the right decisions as he saw them. And, you know, I think most, as did everyone in public health, that took a lot of heat along the way.
As I said in the beginning, the Trump administration fast-tracked Joe, the production of these vaccines. So he deserves credit for that. And yet, followers of Donald Trump kind of helped politicize the vaccines themselves and raised a lot of false narratives about those vaccines. It would be later, in the early part of the Biden administration, if I recall correctly, that the CDC required face masks to be worn by all travelers on public transportation and inside transportation hubs. The masks became political. Remind us why, Joe.
the masks did become political. There were debates over their efficacy. There were debates over personal freedoms on whether someone could require you to wear a face cloth. And there were debates over enforcement, whether you should be banned from accessing other members of the public, places in the public sphere because you aren't wearing a mask. Over the course of the pandemic, we saw lots of things become politicized. Masks, of course, were one of them.
Well, I was going to ask Dr. Washington about that, because the pushback, much of the pushback on masks, it seems to me, and if I recall correctly, had to do with the fact that they were mandated in some cases, and people don't want to be told what to do in a free country. And yet we are told that we must wear seatbelts, although there's been some pushback to that too. We are told that there are prohibitions against drinking and driving. We are told something simple like, if you want to get married, you have to get a marriage license. So what can we do next time to make mask wearing, where it is applicable, because it's not applicable in all disease cases, or any other precaution that we might need to take? What can we do to make that less controversial, to make people feel that they are contributing to the solution rather than being forced to do something that they would rather not do in a free country?
Yeah, I think your examples are a perfect example for how we communicate to the public, right? You know, this is another tool in our toolbox that allows us to keep people safe. And it's no different than wearing a seatbelt because it is just a preventive measure to reduce risk of transmitting a virus. In healthcare settings, people wear masks still every day. It's an important tool that we use. And so I think some of the noise around mask was really driven by folks and their personal freedoms and desires to sort of want to not comply with what was being asked. And I do think that some of that was uniquely an American problem. I know other countries where there was compliance was not an issue. It didn't become a debate around mask. And so I'm hopeful that, you know, the next threat that comes that might require us to use tools like that, people will remember that all the lives that you mentioned earlier that were lost as a result of COVID, it became the third leading cause of death here in Mecklenburg County in just a short period of time. That's unprecedented for any cause of death to become a third leading cause of death that quickly. And so it's important to remember.
There was some question about the efficacy of these masks, and some people said you could wear a piece of cloth over your face, like a bandana across your face, and that would be good. Well, no, that wasn't good enough. You could just go to the store and buy one of these paper masks, these disposable. That was good enough. No, that wasn't good enough. You had to have special high density. So when you get the right mask, is it effective? Does it slow down or stop the spread of COVID and other respiratory viruses? Dr. Passeretti, go ahead.
Yeah, I think masks, when worn appropriately, work very, very well. There are a number of studies that have shown that, you know, for N95, that type of mask, as well as surgical masks. So they do a good job of blocking the virus from getting to other people and keeping things out. So 100% they work when used appropriately. Some of the challenge with, how people apply the mandates is they're wearing it below their nose. You know, if you don't have it on, it can't do its job. So it muddies the picture and creates, challenges with communicating the data behind masks.
Yeah, I saw a lot of people wearing them over their mouth, but not their nose. That defeats the purpose. We have other viruses to be concerned about in 2025. Bird flu is making the rounds. Whooping cough is making a limited comeback. Texas, I think New Mexico and one other state, I think Maryland, is experiencing a measles outbreak. So let me start with the last two, whooping cough and measles. Is there any reason other than people refusing to have their children vaccinated that these viruses are making a comeback, are making people sick, and in some cases, causing their deaths?
So there is not, these viruses are the same viruses that have been around for forever. It really, these outbreaks are all originating from areas that are under vaccinated or individuals who are not vaccinated. So it really does tie back to the vaccine issue. We have very good tools to prevent both and prevent both from having significant illness. But there are pockets of individuals that choose not to use them.
And Dr. Washington, according to KFF Health News, routine vaccination rates for kindergarten children around the country are continued to decline, while exemptions from school vaccination requirements, particularly non-medical exemptions, have increased. As a public health official, what is the official policy in North Carolina or for schools here in terms of childhood vaccinations necessary to keep these viruses at bay?
Yeah, so in North Carolina, those the basic recommended vaccines for children are required to enter public schools. Families can choose to, as you mentioned, elect to file for a medical or religious exemption. We've seen pretty stable numbers of medical exemptions. These are kids who can't take the vaccine because of some medical contraindication. They're allergic to something that's in it. But we have seen this really large increase in folks who are claiming religious exemption from that requirement. As that number goes up, our overall coverage rates in the school district goes down and puts more kids at risk for potential outbreaks. We also have kids who don't file exemptions but aren't up to date. And so there are hundreds of kids who right now, even in CMS, who have not are not up to date on their measles vaccines across all grade levels that our team is working with to make sure we get those kids up to date.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump vowed to stop all COVID mandates, and he said that he would cut federal funding to schools with a vaccine or a mask mandate. He has supported anti-vaccination attitudes and shared some vaccine misinformation. He chose Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a vaccine conspiracy theorist, as the head of the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Washington, as a public health official, does this keep you up at night?
I think the rising sort of lack of trust in the tools that we know are effective is what keeps me up at night. It's really important to that we take advantage of the tools we have available. And vaccines are the safest and most effective route to keep us from things like what's happening right now in Texas with the measles outbreak.
So Dr. Passeretti, talk to me about the negative effects of getting vaccinated for measles or whooping cough or diseases like polio. Are there any?
So there are, as Dr. Washington referenced, there are some people either because certain vaccines can't take them because they have an allergic reaction or they have a compromised immune system and it's a live vaccine. But we have years and years of experience with these vaccines that are recommended, and they are highly safe, highly effective at doing what they're supposed to do and keeping kids and, you know, frankly, adults safe.
And a lot of people, because bad news or false news, lies travel more quickly than the truth. A lot of people are subject to taking in a lot of bad information and believing it. And they will defend their belief, anti-vaccine beliefs, because they have, quote, done their research. Well, that's a good thing. People should be doing their research. They should be looking into, but where should they do that research? If they want to do their research, where should they be turning?
Yeah, you know, the misinformation issue around vaccines that was mentioned previously really haunts me as a provider. You know, I think the loss of trust in your physicians, in science, in healthcare is a horrible consequence of the COVID pandemic. And, you know, your physician, your medical provider is responsible for kind of helping guide you in those decisions. You know, there are a number of good sources of information, whether from your public health department, you know, all the states have information on vaccines, CDC. There are a number of sources of good information. I would say not Facebook, not Twitter, you know, try to go to the, talk to your doctor, go to those primary sources.
Dr. Washington?
Yeah, I was just going to say where not to look, you know, Twitter, Facebook, any other source of your, sometimes not even your neighbor or friend.
Joe?
Yeah, I think one of the best pieces of advice that Dr. Mandy Cohen had was like, hey, if you're skeptical about anything, just talk to your personal doctor, talk to your pediatrician. They can come up with the best plan for you. And, you know, another impact of the pandemic has been kind of this rise of misinformation. Even with content monitoring, it's not the same now as it was 5 years ago. So you're starting to see more things pop up on your Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, any social media you have. And, you know, another impact is there is just more skepticism now among all vaccines that people didn't really talk about 5 years ago, from hepatitis B for newborns to measles, as we're starting to see the outbreaks. RFK even wrote an editorial on Fox News recently encouraging people to get their measles shot. So I think, you know, going forward, a story will be reintroducing vaccines and talking about their efficacy and having those conversations with doctors.
And about the consequences of diseases like polio, like measles, like whooping cough that have virtually disappeared in this country because of vaccines. So people have no experience with the consequences of them. Dr. Katie Passeretti of Atrium Health, Dr. Raynard Washington from Mecklenburg County, Joe Bruner from WSOC. Thank you for joining us.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.